part of it is, as you just stated, that if it's 10, 15, and 20, the first portion of the element next after the feed point on the drift-driven element should be about 8 feet. Am I correct what you said that way, Dick, for 10 meters over?
There's sort of a yes and a no to that, Mel. If it was a simplistic dipole all by itself-like design, one possible way of doing it would be plus or minus 8 feet, then an LC trap tuned to, let's say, 28.5 megacycles, so that when you're on 10 meters, no substantial amount of energy flows beyond the plus or minus 8-foot point on the intersection of the dipole. That's one way of doing it. It ain't the only way. The next level of sophistication would be you start using less and less capacitance, maybe use a little bit more inductance, maybe you move the position of the inductance a little bit, and you use some of the capacitive reactants of the rest of the driven element beyond the plus or minus 8-foot point. So there's lots of ways of doing this, and if you take something as complicated as a, let me pick a number, a 5-element tri-band beam, let me drop.
In KC2QIQ with a comment.
Quite recognized. You take a 5-element beam made for 10, 15, and 20, and you decide to make it apparate on 10, 15, and 30, and if it was only a driven element dipole, and you want to reverse engineer that and modify it, I think you can do it. But when it comes to a multi-element Yagi, where you've got all kinds of parasitic inductors, chokes, and whatever, on the parasitic elements, and various amounts of coupling coefficients between them, and you want to move at least one of those frequency ranges and favor it in both gain, front-to-back ratio, and standing wave ratio for your particular frequency you want to add, 30 meters, in my opinion, that's quite difficult. You could spend a year of your life perfecting that design by tinkering in the backyard easily, in my opinion, Mel. But maybe Glenn's already done that. Maybe Glenn's reverse engineered some of those. Maybe he knows of where somebody has done a breakdown and photograph. And so what's your experience with these multi-band beam-like things, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Well, I can't really speak to the beams again, but I've done it with dipoles. And to make multi-band dipoles, I found it really isn't that difficult. It's just as long as you keep all the lengths for each band within quarter waves. So in other words, like if you had 10 meters, you're going to start with the shortest length first to the center, and you're going to start off with a length that's approximately quarter wave on both sides of your dipole, and cut the wire there. So so you're starting off a little bit on the long side. Then what you do is the extension at the end would be for the next band up, like say if you want 30 meters. So what you do is you count from the point, from the feed point all the way to the tip, that additional length to give you a total of quarter wave length on 30 meters. Now the trick is you have to put an inductor in between to trap off 10 so it doesn't interfere with 30 meters. So that's where it takes a little bit of experimentation. And usually it takes an air-wound core and usually a few microhenries. And, you know, rule of thumb is, you know, usually for, like, say, to separate a few turns, it's usually in the HF band, it's usually like, you know, 20 turns or something like that of number, you know, 10-gauge wire on a piece of PVC, and just to give yourself a few microhenry, you know, say a microhenry or so, and just to split up to choke off the other length, so that really it's just resonant on 10 meters first and ignores the rest. But it does take a little bit of experimentation. The inductance part, to get the right inductance, I don't have a good calculation for that, Dick. Besides, I have another question for you after this one, too. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Let me say something completely different.
Yeah, first, Glenn. Glenn, when you wound those coils, was there any capacitance involved, or you used nothing but loading inductors at various portions along this multi-band dipole that you built? Back to you, Glenn.
Just a little, just really inductance. And as a matter of fact, what I've found sometimes is when I put the inductor on the end of a quarter wavelength, like on 10 meters, sometimes I have to shorten it up, just shorten up the 10 meter just a little bit. to get a better tune on that band, because initially the initial quarter wavelength might be a little bit too long. So just, but yeah, it's just pure inductance, no capacitance whatsoever, Dick.
I'm going to pass it back to Mel now. And Mel, in your opinion, when you took apart these metal sheath trapped inductor assemblies with screws in them, do you believe that that trap was very close to plus or minus 8 feet away from the boom? Or do you think that that distance to the trap was also adjusted more or less than 8 feet in the case of the 10-meter section? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Exactly. I can understand how to do it with a dipole. Yes, you can. Very simple. They got a lot of that in the book, how to make trap dipoles and all. But that's not the way this thing works, because the distance, and like you say, is always plus or minus somewhere around 8 feet. And for the, if it's a 10, 15, 20 meter dipole you're making, in this case, the element falls, the length falls nowhere near. It's too long for 10 meters, this I can tell you. It's too long for 15 meters. It's somewhere around, on this particular beam, 12 foot before that so-called coil assembly. Then you got this assembly. Now, let me let it drop, and then I'll tell you something else very interesting. Okay. They give you, when you're putting this thing together, you know, you assemble it. Now they say you make a choice. Do you want to use the bottom end, like, more towards the CW? They give you three choices, for instance. You want the middle of the band, you want the lower part of the band, you want the mostly emphasized, the upper part, more towards the upper, say, part of the band. Let's say you're more like a CW fan. The only thing you do is adjust this outer little, this outer piece of metal that sticks out there at the end. You do not do any other adjustment on any other place. So tell me, you got a piece of like 11 feet to 12 feet of pipe. Yeah, 12 feet. It was 12 feet 2 inches, basically, before this coil. Then this coil sits there. And then there's a little piece of pipe that sticks out of the coil like exactly 21 inches thick. And that covers 10, 15, and 20. Same thing repeats itself, of course, each side of the boom. That's the driven element. And the matching is, well, they have a couple different matchings, but one of the matchings is very unique. Over.
KC2QIQ with comment.
Glenn recognized. But first, Mel, are you telling me that a 10, 15, and 20 meter driven element only contains one set of traps, and those set of traps were roughly at the 12-foot point on that driven element? Is that what you're saying, Glenn? I mean, Mel, go ahead.
Exactly. There's only one. There's one of these assemblies, that closed assembly on each side of the boom. That's it, and that's the way that, and each, the driven element, the reflector, and the director, all are in the same type of assembly. There's not two traps on the modern one. Just, if you want to call it a trap, again, sure, I can understand how you do it with a dipole, trap dipoles and all, but this is not the way it's done on these tri-banders, Dick, over.
Yeah, Dick, that was my initial question. You look up and you only see the one, you don't see the two on each side.
That'd be the answer to that.
Yeah, putting in the double would be the first step in the development, and these guys have gone a couple of steps beyond. Go right ahead, Glenn.
I'm assuming you guys are talking about 10, 15, 20-meter beams. Is that correct?
I think we are, Glenn. Go ahead.
Okay, it just so happens, if you're going to cut a wavelength for 10, 15, and 20, you're going to look to line up the bands so that they overlap each other, so that they're harmonically associated to each other. And what they do is they'll pick sections of the band, and what they'll do is they tune the first element for some match, which could be like 5/8 wave. It doesn't exactly have to be quarter. It could be half, 5/8, some good fraction where they get like a fairly decent match. Now, it's not going to be 1-to-1. It might, on that particular band, it might be like 1.5-to-1. Then what they'll do is, to get the second band, what they'll do is they'll wind the trap and add it just by itself, and hang it off the end of the first part of the driven element at that point right there. Now, that just trap sitting on there by itself will resonate with the almost like a little bit of a distance of a little bit of wire length on the end, and almost acting like a little capacitance hat. Just so at the end gives you the second band. To get the third band for the lowest end of the frequency, then they add an additional length after that, and that gives you the third band. So it's actually the what makes the what completes the second band is actually that. That choke itself actually makes the second band, usually for 15 meters. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Very cute. And yeah, each half on each side doesn't have to be quarter wave. Half wave would work, 5/8 wave would work. It's going to give a slightly lumpy pattern, but the average guy cares more about standing wave ratio than he does about pattern of the driven element. And the rest of the directors now start sharpening up that pattern the way you desire if they're properly designed. A tri-band Yagi is no simple design. And the number of interacting functions going on here, I think, is part of the reason why none of our amateur radio antenna handbooks cover that subject very much. On top of that, the successful designs that are out there in the manufactured world are the result of lots of man years of tinkering, and each individual vendor considers that design proprietary to him. That's his business. And so they'd be giving away the secret, so to speak, if that appeared in the ARRL antenna handbook. That's my guess as to why so little of that information is there. On top of that, if we amateurs tried duplicating those and didn't use the exact materials in just the right way, we can get in a fair amount of trouble as far as performance is concerned. So because of the risk factor of violating a confidence to a vendor, to a an advertiser, and the risk factor of amateurs having some difficulty duplicating the antenna, I am guessing these are some of the reasons why we don't see these in the radio amateurs handbooks or in the ARRL antenna books. Ain't simple. There's 5,000 kinds of antennas, and there's probably, when it comes to impedance matching this now, when at certain frequencies it's a quasi-half-wave dipole, at other frequencies it's a 5/8, somewhere else maybe it's a three-quarter-wave dipole, that makes the impedance have crazy resistive components and crazy reactive components. So I'm guessing the impedance matching network at the feed point of the antenna is not exactly simple, is it, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
To say the least, because there's two or three of them that have some real wild ways of doing it. And you say, Glenn says, yeah, overlapping, but you got to really look at it. Like you say, most people would, you know, if they bought that beam and then on 10 meters had a decent SWR, let's say somewhere around 1.5, but you went to 15 and it was a 3 or something, oh, that would be it. Get it out of here. No damn good. These goddamn antennas work. If it's 1.5, you set it up for the CW portion of the band, and it's 1.5 on 10, it's 1.5 on 15, and it's 1.5 on 20 meters. Now I said, well, I want this element. I got laying here. This driven element, I was thinking, I'd like to make a the cover. I was just thinking, you know, good idea. Can I convert this thing? I don't need the three elements. Oh, no, it was actually a six-element beam. Came down pretty hot, bent up a lot of materials. Not in the best of shape, but enough salvage. If I want to just turn it into a two-element 30 and 40-meter antenna, could I do it? How do you go about it? What am I looking at? You got to tinker. You got to start and say, gee, I want to wind an inductor. What kind of inductor am I starting with? How do I go about? What length am I starting with, Dick? With the element, over.
Yeah, if I understand you correctly, Mel, you'd like to be able to take a tri-bander made for 10, 15, and 20 meters, for instance, or maybe 10, 15, and 30 meters, and now modify the design to make it work on 40 as a three-element Yagi or a two-element Yagi. If it was only a one-element Yagi, you just want to make the driven element work at 40 meters, when it was designed to work at those three other frequencies, how would you go about that? One approach would be to recognize that the actual radiator itself, the driven element, doesn't have to be resonant at the frequency of interest. The so-called infinitesimal dipole section of the antenna book by Krauss makes that clear. If you got the right kind of impedance matching network, which you could view as a very low loss feed line, maybe open wire line, into an extremely high quality antenna tuner, you can make any length of antenna be a moderately good radiator at your favorite frequency. So there's nothing magic about making it resonant. It would be nice if you could make it resonant, but it doesn't have to be. You could take that 10, 15, 30 meter tri-band Yagi and decide that, the parasitic elements are not going to tune right, they're not going to be there, but at least I can use it on 40 meters. If I pour 40 meter energy into it with a very low loss feed line, and I've got a very wide band antenna tuner, that would work. So the coils that you're looking for and the extra length that you're looking for electronically could take place inside of your antenna tuner. You may end up with 85% efficiency, but you're on the air. What do you think of that approach, Mel?
K2. Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Over to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Ahead of you. Said it, tried it. I took it. That's what I was going to say. Why? Because I don't want to throw too much out there at one time. I took the 20 meter, the driven element from the 10, 15, 20 meter beam, and I said, ha-ha, I got an idea. I'll take that end piece out that goes, you know, sticks out after the coil or trap or whatever the heck you want to call it, the resonator, and I'll add in another piece of pipe, and I'll keep moving this piece of pipe around, and I'll watch my antenna analyzer and see why I can't get it to work on 30 meters. I won't jump yet to 40. Let me move from 20, which is 14 megahertz, to 10 megahertz. I'm not going that far. I'm only going to 4 megahertz. Should be able to work, maybe. Get it to work. Well, I played around. I got it so like a... I think I got it right down to like 2.5 or something. I don't know. I sort of got it to some spot because, you know, first of all, the 30-meter band is a small band, only 50, actually, you only use maybe about 50 kilohertz of the bands and everything, so like from 10-100 to 10-150 or so. So, you know, you can do a little experiment. And I had this thing, I stuck it up there on my so-called antenna test range. But the dipole, the 30-meter dipole, outperformed the dick and just knocked it out over.
What's your guess as to how many dB down it was, Mel, and were you feeding it with an antenna tuner?
Tried it every which way. Yeah, I figured I'd tune out the reactance with the tuner, figuring, I'll get it. Of course, with that tuner that I got there, you can, you actually can load up your bed spring, literally. But just didn't perform. I had the 30-meter dipole and the up there, and this element up there on my map, same height and everything like that. I use that beacon station. It's got two Dell teletype beacon stations. One operates at 10.100. The other one operates at 10.150. So I can use them, and I can see right away it was down considerable, Dick. Almost to the point where I'd say this antenna is almost hardly seems to be working over.
Now, the original tri-band beam had what you've already described to us as a fairly elaborate impedance matching network in order to give a reasonably good standing wave ratio at the three bands it was designed for. I wonder if it's possible that that impedance network that was never intended for 30 meters or 40 meters, could that have been fighting you and making things really terrible, that a different impedance matching network at the end of the transmission line would have helped? What do you think, Mel?
Well, this impedance matching network, let me describe it. You tell me what you call it. They got to take a piece of RG8U, get rid of the shield, take two pieces of it, approximately, let me see, how long was it? 6 feet. 6 feet long, you're taking two pieces, one piece, and you're putting in the middle of the element, and you're putting this insulator, you know, that separates. The two elements come together there, and then they sit on a bar of aluminum that supports the two elements. And in the center there, they got a connector. Now, on the connector, one piece of this six-foot piece of RG8U, that's all it looks like, slips into the element, does not touch, the wire doesn't touch the element, just slips in there, the end is clipped off and sealed off, and the other piece goes to the shield of the coax and slips into the element on the other side. That's so-called how it matches. So I said to myself, aha, all you have to do maybe is lengthen this a little bit, add a 2 foot onto it, let me see the difference. It doesn't change it. It will not. I tried. I fiddled with it. I even shortened it a little. Nothing. It doesn't change. But yet it works on 20 meters. I was dumbfounded, Dick. I just thought of, I said, something going on here. I don't understand. And Paul didn't bring it up. I've been puzzled. I thought maybe I'd come up with the answer to this puzzle and give you a surprise. But I'm as dumbfounded with this as ever. And I looked in books and places. There is no idea of how this damn thing works. To tell you the truth, how they came up with this hocus pocus, yet that works so well, over.
Yeah, on the frequencies of interest, let me drop. That center conductor and dielectric of a piece of RG8U slipped into the tubing. Naively, you could say, gee, that's just a distributed capacitor. Uh-uh. That's a kind of a stub. That is a kind of piece of coaxial cable with an open circuit at one end inside there. So at particular frequencies, it's got a particular reaction. And at some other frequency, it's nothing but a simple coupling capacitor. That's my best guess as to why at your 40-meter band, changing that length didn't seem to do much. It wasn't tuned to that length, so to speak. You'd have to make a whole lot of change in length to get back to where it tunes for 20 meters. 40 meters. That's a guess. Yeah. Reverse engineering these antennas is far from easy, as we're discovering. And so what Paul and I and others have seen when we looked up at those tri-band beams that were used at various field day sites this weekend, there's a lot more going on than first meets the eye. We haven't got the answers yet. And it's going to take a while. So, don't hold your breath on this one, Paul. You've stumped the crew that's arrived here tonight as far as a complete understanding. We got little pieces of the puzzle, but we don't have the whole picture yet. Let me drop.
One more thing to tell you, another surprise.
Yeah, go ahead, Mel.
Okay, they offer you on a number of their beam designs a add-on kit for 40 meters. Now, what's the add-on kit? You leave everything intact, and you put another one of these little these contraptions, whatever it is, you put it on after that. In other words, now you got two of these contraptions connected to each other, and then another piece of stuff sticking out. So I said, oh, I get it. They're taking, adding to 20 meters, adding the piece, makes it now electrically lengthening to 40. I tried. I added, I took coils. I did all kinds of hocus pocus. I can't get the goddamn thing now to work. It makes it work when you get this thing from them, and you know a few guys that did it. It makes the beam now work 10, 15, 20, and 40 meters thick, over.
If I understand you correctly now, Mel, you know of people who bought the real kit from the manufacturer, and it works rather well. And I think you're saying that either the purchaser or you looked at the kit, thought you understood what materials are there. You therefore homebrewed that kind of material yourself on your Yagi of identical model number, and it didn't perform, is what I think you're saying. As if the eye sees certain things when you look at that kit, but maybe there's something else there that we didn't see. Back to you, Mel.
Exactly. Well, I couldn't take it apart, the kit, of course. I couldn't ask somebody to, you know, let me take your kit apart. But they put them in, and I said, does it work? He says, it works phenomenal. I said, for God's sake, how the heck are they doing it? I said, what can they add on to make now 20 meters extended? Is it now going through a trap? But how do they work this out that now it matches now 40 meters? So now you got 10, 15, 20, and 40 all working well with adding on this little thing. I said, gee, maybe just all I have to do is fool around with some electrical, you know, wind coil. I see the size, the same physical size of the trap coil or whatever it is before. It looks exactly the same. You take the rod out that you have there now, that end piece. You slip this one in, goes right up against it, within an inch, just butts up against it, and you stick the rod now back into the end of this new piece you added, and bingo. They tell you how to, you know, where the in fact, it's pre-drilled for you, Dick, and it works. And I says, how do they do this? And how's the matching network all of a sudden picking this up, too? How can this standard matching network be doing all this hocus-pocus? It sounds like there's something going on that I don't understand, to tell you the truth, after all these years. Like you said, it must be some really secretive engineering over.
Now, you're starting off with a tri-band beam, 2, 3, 4 elements on each of those frequencies. And then when you add this kit for 40-meter performance, I presume it is a 40-meter dipole, and the rest of the parasitic elements might not be there, and it's not a Yagi on 40 meters. Is that approximately true, Mel?
Well, they offer you several. Now, listen to this. If you just want a rotary dipole for 40 meters, you get the simple kit. In other words, you just put it on to the driven element, and now you've added 40 meters onto it. Now, they only offer this kit on their three-element version beam. If you want to go a step further, they offer a kit now to add to the reflector, which turns this thing into a two-element. But they do not offer one to add to the director. In other words, you can't make a three-element 40 on it. You can go to a two-element 40 as far as they say. Now, my friend bought this thing in Pennsylvania, and he says, I says, what happens when you rotate? He says, no, it's got a very good front to back and seems to have some decent forward gain, he says, compared to what I was, when I first, originally, he says, you know, you can buy it in pieces. In other words, you don't have to buy a complete two setup initially. You can buy one just for the driven element, and then later on, you can add on the other kit. So he made the rotary dipole first for 40, saw it perform real well, bought the kit now to add on to the reflector to make it now a two-element 40, and he says it works now 10 through 40, and he says it works phenomenally well, Dick. So, I don't know. I guess, like I say, found it fascinating just as an experimental thing, just to make it a rotary dipole that's 10, 15, 20, and 40, and with this, just this one element, and I can't come up with it, over.
And 2GYN.
And 2GYN recognized. We'll get to you in a second. GYN. In the case of adding the more elaborate kit that gives you a two-element Yagi on 40 meters, I've got a little feeling for what's going on there. A two-element Yagi, driven element and reflector. The spacing to the driven element and reflector is very forgiving. Properly tune that reflector and the driven element, and there's a large range of spacings in which you'll get performance front-to-back ratio. In the case of a director, you don't have quite that much freedom. You need a minimum spacing for the director to really fly. And where that director was already set up, at least one of the directors was set up for 10 meters and 15 meters, to stretch that very short spacing in wavelength on 40 meters means you're going to get very little reaction out of that reflector, out of that director. That's my guess as to what's going on. N2GYN, thought of your name, sir, and your comment or question. Oh, wait a minute. If it's question, we're going to add you to the list. There's one person ahead of you named Joe. N2GYN, K2RIW, and TechNet. Start off with your name, sir.
Don't forget me, Dick, too. I have a question, KC2QIQ.
Okay. GYN, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Hi, Dick. This is John, N2GYN. Yeah, it's a micro question, so I'm just going to go out on a limb here, and I just wanted to ask Mel, the tri-bander that he did this experiment with, that he did, would it happen to be a TA-33 Mosley? Okay. Well, yeah, my other choice was a Chris-Craft 8-4, but okay. That's all I wanted to ask. Back to that.
Was a Mosley, but not the TA-33. It was part of TA-36.
Okay, because they both offered the add-on kit, and it's funny because 20 years ago, I experimented the same thing that you're describing, and found things that made no sense, got into some interesting conversation with the owner, the original owner of Mosley, who has passed away some time ago now, but I even went as far as speaking to the designer, the owner of original Mosley, and found some interesting answers, but I it still made no sense to me at the end of the day. Okay, back to Net Control. Dick, thank you. And did you want him?
I had the same experience with Carl Mosley.
Yeah. I can tell you my... again, there's other people waiting, and I don't want to hog it, but I can give you a conversation I had with him that went on for, of course, 3 days, and about his design. Again, there was other people in there, and I don't want to hog it. If you go through the people and I'm still up and around, I'll come back with it. Answered you in.
Gotcha. Even eyeball to eyeball, I got nowhere.
You took it at least one step further. And a very persistent man, very persistent to, and there was no bending. So it sounds like you experienced the same thing with Carl. Okay.
I'm going to guess that Carl was either a little bit paranoid or fighting very hard to hold on to the proprietariness of his design. He didn't want to give away the store. That's a guess. Glenn, KC2QIQ, go right ahead. K2RAW on the TechNet.
Yeah, actually, my question, Dick, it's along the same lines, but it's different. It's not traps. It's on the step tuning. Last week, I sent you a copy of that instruction manual of how that high tower antenna goes together. And they use a single feed point, or at least it looks like it's a single feed point, with stud matches on that tower. And they get, 10 through 80 on this thing. And I was just wondering, maybe you could say some words on stub tuning and how that might work. K2RAW, KC2QIQ.
I seem to remember it was a shunt feeding arrangement. In other words, from the base of the tower, there was a wire that stands off from the side of the tower, parallel to the tower for a certain distance, goes up the tower, and then makes contact. I think that's called a shunt feeding arrangement. And was that the primary feed for most of those bands? Glenn, go ahead.
That's the way it appears, Dick. I read through that assembly manual like 4 times, and it appears that there's only one feed line, and the other bands are basically, what it looks like, are just mechanically connected, like stubs on the side to get the other bands, and it just left me scratching my head, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, where you feed, shunt feed the tower, that one particular position could work very nicely at one band, give you the impedance you want, the reactance that you want, near zero reactance. And then the whole antenna is going to be highly reactive on other frequencies that are not 3-to-1 harmonically related. And the remaining reactance, in many cases, can be subtracted by the opposite magnitude of reactance from a stub. And now, how do you make the stubs take off and do their job at one frequency but not interfere with another? Ain't easy. Lots and lots of combinations here have to be tried before you find the combination for your particular antenna design. That's a rather well-constructed thing, that vertical tower-like structure. Let me drop. I can see why it's a little bit pricey. I believe it's somewhat foreshortened from the particular frequencies it's on. It's not a quarter wavelength on the lowest frequency. But There's nothing magic about forcing the antenna all by itself to be resonant if you got the right impedance matching network in the right location. At the antenna is the best location, but if the feed line is low enough in laws and there's enough hair in the chest of your antenna tuner, then you can still get a high percentage of the performance you desire by using that antenna tuner in the shack. There's an amazing number of people out there who have the misconception that when there is standing wave ratio on your antenna plus feed line, that by some non-magic, all the reverse power that represents the standing wave ratio gets absorbed by the antenna tuner and thrown away. Nice sounding theory, but it's rather strong violation of conservation of energy. You can't dissipate RF energy without radiating it in the form of a radio wave or radiating it in the form of heat, turning it into heat, dissipating it. Those are the only ways you can get rid of RF energy. Now, if you're not smart enough, that radiation of heat might be taking place in your feed line because the feed line's running an extremely high standing wave ratio and it's not a low enough loss material. Rich N2EO and N2MB Barry have both run into the problem with an extremely high standing wave ratio antenna fed with a very good tuner with what they thought was a good brand of coaxial cable, behaved quite poorly until they flipped over to open wire line. And the open wire line has so much lower in loss than any reasonable coax you can lay your hands on that the problem went away. The non-resonant antenna can be fed with an antenna tuner, the right kind of an antenna tuner that's made for feeding open wire line, which quite often is a link coupling. I was having a conversation with John, KC2WGB, last night at the Limark field day site. And, another John that was at the Lockfield site. Had a conversation with him, and he found out that link coupling is the only way that works really well with the currently available antenna tuners when you're feeding open wire line. Let me drop.
Hey, that was me, Dick.
Yeah, I kind of thought so. I'm reasonably sure that at least at one band, open wire line can be fed with a half-wave coax balun into a antenna tuner, from an antenna tuner, that's feeding coax. John, when you did that, you didn't try a half-wave coax balun as a way of feeding the open wire line. Is that roughly true?
That's correct. In other words, right straight from the back of the radio into the tuner, from the tuner post right to the lateral line.
Yeah, if your antenna tuner, John's experience is that if the antenna tuner has a link coupling, feeding open wire line works very well. But most of the other techniques do not. But it is my belief that once you've got open wire line and an antenna tuner that does not have a link coupling favoring open wire line, I think you can establish a moderately good open wire line feeding with a half-wave coax balun. But if you're using the open wire line on, say, 80 or 160 meters, I will admit that the length of that half-wave coax balun, which by definition is a half-wave length, is going to be pretty darn long piece of coax on 80 or 160 meters. So maybe the link coupling is the right way to go, and that's what John's experience is. But except for that feed line loss problem of extremely high VSWR, the antenna itself doesn't have to be resonant. And maybe the antenna tuner, to force it into electronic resonance, is going to have to be a structure mounted right at the antenna so that the feed line is now back to running a reasonably low standing wave ratio. And this vertical tower antenna that you're describing, Glenn, I think is one of those. Any further comments on this? Because obviously we don't know enough yet. K2RIW listening.
Yeah, I guess just the only other comment that I've got, Dick, is that, it's a very interesting antenna. Very hard to believe that somebody calculated where those elements went. Something tells me that there was a lot of experimentation to get that antenna the way that they got it. And just from my experiments of, you know, making my own verticals and working with dipoles and things, that when I start to make multi-band antennas, one of the biggest problems that I've had is I can always get the match. You know, I can always basically get a, you know, fit the bands together and get the matches. But what I find is that even though I've got a good match a lot of times, the antenna doesn't seem to perform that well on certain bands. Just certain antennas seem to favor. I'm not sure, I would imagine it's got something to do with takeoff angle of the antenna. That if you get it wrong on one band, yeah, the match will be good. But the antenna almost acts like a dummy load. Like the, it sounds dead, you know. Or it just it's not the signal doesn't propagate very well. Maybe you can say a couple of words on that one as well. It's one of the things that's always confused me, you know. Or, you know, I get a good match on one antenna, it works great on a couple of bands, but the other band just is kind of like, you know, a little foul. And then, you know, with a little bit more experimentation, moving things around, sometimes I'll get a just as good a match, but it just performs better on old bands. If you know what I'm saying? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
K2KEY.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. Some years ago, Communications Quarterly. I knew what one it was, and, you know, so I had some notes on it. Went ahead and had a nice article, I think it was two articles, on shunt feeding towers. In fact, it gave you formulas and ways of determining if your tower was so high, and if it had this size beam on top of it, and all, how much you have to go up the tower to put the gamma rod, and how to match it at the bottom. It was, that's what this high tower became based on. The gentleman who did the design of this shunt feeding and came up with all this system, eventually that high gain adopted it and called it the high tower, over.
I just took a quick look at the third edition of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, looking in the index for shunt feeding. I didn't get a hit. I have to look a little bit further into the vertical antenna section. I'm reasonably sure that some of the techniques for shunt feeding are covered in some hidden section of that handbook, Antenna Engineering Handbook. It sort of would have to be. When it comes to an antenna that gives you poor performance, even though you seem to be getting a good match, I can think of only two ways that can happen, three ways that can happen, Glenn. Number one, if the antenna is not a half wavelength above the ground for a horizontally polarized antenna, you're going to have mostly a cloud warmer, as they say, a near vertical incident sky wave antenna. Because of the way the horizontally polarized signal reflecting off the ground reverses in phase, until you get something like half wavelength of altitude of the antenna, you get a rather poor signal on the horizon. And that's where the DX is located. Let me drop. So that's one factor, altitude. Another factor is real insertion loss. Whatever method you've used for creating the impedance match, somewhere in your radiating structure, antenna tuner, feed line, match of the antenna, and the antenna itself, loss is taking place. And the third section would be when you're comparing A to B, where you're doing it on the same day with the same polarization, if one antenna was vertical and one antenna was horizontal. So, do you believe when you saw an antenna that did give you reasonably good impedance match, but rather poor performance, do you believe the polarization was the same, the altitude was the same, or adequate altitude was present? And do you have reason to believe not a whole lot of loss was taking place, that if you put 1,500 watts in it, something wouldn't be smoking? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I think I did enough experimenting, Dick, where I kind of proved out that the loss wasn't really the issue, because nothing was really getting hot, and I experimented even putting, you know, some decent power into it to see that that wasn't the problem. I do think it has more to do with altitude and mounting. Sometimes I find when I'm doing, you know, it's not, I never see this issue when I'm doing like a single band antenna. It's only when you're doing the multi-band, when I'm doing a multi-band like that. And sometimes I get also the suspicion that it might be some interreactions, like either because of not the correct altitude for that antenna, or maybe just needs a whole lot more altitude to be more effective, or, you know, the other thing is maybe that there's some interreaction with something else close by, like maybe the supporting pole or something along those lines. But I think you probably hit it right on the money with that one.
words, your strongest suspicion right now is altitude. And so when you were comparing antenna A to antenna B, there was a substantial difference in altitude, and you were quite shy of the half wavelength of altitude above the ground as a minimum altitude, Glenn. Is that what you're saying?
Well, my feeling is that if I were just to take a single band antenna by itself at the same altitude, at the band that I was having problems with on the other antenna, maybe more altitude might have helped it.
That's my best guess. Because I suspect that the antenna you're talking about might not have been large enough to have a substantial directivity pattern to it, where the pattern was aimed in the wrong direction. In other words, the gray line was such that east-west was favored, but your antenna was putting major energy to the north. I don't think you were running into that. And until the antenna has a significant number of elements or a significant amount of wavelengths of aperture to it, it's not going to have a whole lot of directivity. So azimuthal pattern is probably not it. And the elevation pattern, 90-some-odd percent of that is caused by altitude of the antenna. And we all want that signal to be as strong as possible on the horizon, because that's where the ionosphere and the DX is. Let me pick up Joe. We've been keeping him waiting an awful long time. Hope he's still with us. W2RYY. How things in your neighborhood, Joe? K2RIW in the TechNet. I just checked the 147375 machine is in operation, and I think Joe comes in through that machine occasionally. Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet. Okay, maybe Joe got called away. John, I think you said you had a question. N-2-G-Y-N, K-2-R-I-W, go ahead.
Yeah, okay, Dick, N-2-G-Y-N. Yeah, interesting thing with Carl. Some 30 years ago, I had purchased a TA-33, which has got to be one of the most widely sold tri-banders of its day. Oh, my God, there must be millions of those things around. Both the junior, which handled a little less wattage than the senior one. But anyway, I purchased this some 30 years ago, took the antenna up, turned on my radio, and was kind of disappointed in several ways. One, and the largest way, was the front-to-back ratio. Now, when I installed it exactly per instructions. I had it up for about 3 days, and I was speaking to a gentleman on 20. And he had told me what a lot of people do with that antenna, which is they put in a one-to-one balun. And when people do that, it increases the front to back and also a little bit more broadbanded. Let me drop it a second. So what they were using at the time was a made by Hi-Gain, a BN86, which is still made today, and I went out and purchased it, took the antenna down, it was only up 3 days, installed it per what I was told, and put it back up. Well, the performance was dramatically improved. The front to back was much better, at least three times better. It was more broadbanded, and it performed great. But I didn't understand it, because that's not what the manufacturer says to do. I mean, other manufacturers like KLM at the time, they were supplying 4-to-1 balance for their design. No, they said, this needs no balance. So I contacted Mosley, and I had a conversation with Carl about this. And he was kind of heated about it, because it was a known issue that people were doing this to his antenna design, and he didn't like it. And he says, no, that's not the way it was designed. No, it doesn't work that. It can't do that. So, you know, I asked him, have you tried it? I mean, he wouldn't even entertain it. Now, what I'm asking you, Dick, and the other guys on the internet, on the net, is why did the one-to-one Balun increase my front-to-back ratio so much and broadbanded the antenna? And I would say at least 60% of the people that run that antenna run it with that Balun when it wasn't designed for. Or is it back to net? NCGYN.
As I see it, John, the main thing a one-to-one Balun does is get rid of the so-called common mode radiation of your coax cable. We would like the antenna to be a perfectly unbalanced load. In other words, the shield of the coax cable connects to, let's say, the boom of the antenna, and the center conductor of the coax cable connects to some kind of a structure that accepts all that energy, puts it onto the driven element, and any amount of RF energy that the antenna creates that flows back down the outside of the coax cable. That's because the antenna itself is not a perfect unbalanced load. And the antenna is a partially balanced load. If I took, for instance, a driven element that's a dipole where it is a center insulator, and I put the shield to the left side of the dipole and the center conductor to the right side of the dipole, that's a balanced antenna being fed with unbalanced coax cable. You do that kind of a feed, and you'll get a substantial amount of RF energy flowing down the outside of the coax. When that happens, in the worst case, you've got RF in the shack, and if you're using a D104 mic, let me drop, and you put your lip near the mic, it bites you. And that's the worst case situation. But still, any radiation from the coax cable, by definition, is going to have very poor front-to-back ratio. But yet you're going to see it. You're going to see it in the antenna pattern. Putting in the Balun, the one-to-one Balun, its main function in life is to act as an RF choke only on the outside of the coax cable. It has no effect on what's going on between center conductor and shield. And so the fact that you stop the cable from radiating can make a substantial difference in front-to-back ratio if the antenna had front-to-back ratio itself, but the coax was itself radiating. Now, each one of us, when we put up a TA-33, the way we dress our coax cable, does it come straight down a radio tower, or is the antenna mounted to the chimney of the house and the coax cable leaves the chimney and goes parallel to the roof of the house for a while and then goes into the eaves of the house somewhere? Depending on the dress of the coax cable and if it's radiating, it can make a substantial difference to the pattern of the antenna and therefore affect the front-to-back ratio. That's my best explanation for how a Balun can make all of that improvement, a one-to-one Balun. I wonder if anyone else has got anything else they want to say along these lines from their personal experience. Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Glenn, recognize?
Why about this?
Glenn and Mel. So Glenn first, go right ahead.
Yeah, Dick, I definitely agree with isolating the common mode interference of the feed line. That definitely, because I've done experiments both ways, even with gamma matches, all different types of matches, and a Balun certainly really isolates the feed line. But the other thing I've noticed, too, is that on center-fed antennas, a lot of times when you're constructing the beam, you're trying to get as precision measurements on the length and the tuning on both sides and getting both sides exactly even. And some of these structures, when you're putting them together, it's hard to get them exact on both sides. But one thing nice about the Balun is, another feature, is that it balances electrically the total half wavelength of the driven element. In other words, even if one side is slightly off from the other or any small errors electrically from one side to the other, the Balun neutralizes the whole element into one balanced driven element. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'm going to explore that a little bit now, Glenn. When you say it's hard to get balanced, I think you're talking about a kind of a driven element structure where the driven element itself is capable of being slid left to right, so to speak. So you can make one side longer and the other side shorter before locking it down. And if you're feeding the driven element in a gamma match-like structure where you're really feeding one side with reference to ground, making the two sides exactly equal, believe it or not, is not desirable. If you really want the boom to be cold and not hot with RF, where the shield is most likely connected, then I think you want to slightly intentionally unbalance the driven element. You're about to ask which direction. I'm not sure. But there is a direction of unbalancing the driven element for a gamma-like structure, which will make it a little bit closer to canceling the common mode RF on the coax cable. I've used that already, and right now, why am I having trouble figuring out which way you should go? I think you make the side that you're feeding a little bit shorter, but I'm not positive on that. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
You're right on with that, Dick, because the location of the gamma match, I think it's not just the tuning of the gamma match, it's the location of the gamma match, sliding it up and down, sometimes just to try to get the best performance, where many times you get that balance in between, and the balance electrically from, you know, left to right-hand side, it just basically takes care of all of those problems. They just kind of go away. It erases them. And some of the benefits are the front-to-back ratio. Some of them are also the benefits of broader band. It allows you to stretch the antenna a little bit further. Maybe the directivity falls off, but certainly the driven element tuning. You get the most out of it that you can. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
WB2HWW, comment question?
Yeah, Howie, you're right after Mel. Mel, go right ahead with your comment on this one. KC2KEY, you got it.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Ha-ha, that's it. Mosley eventually sent addendums around. This is sometime later after I owned the beam for a while. I heard that Carl Mosley was going to demonstrate his wares at a ham convention in Washington, D.C. And at that ham convention, in the backyard, they had a tower, a crank-up tower. And on top of it, he had one of his beams sitting on there. And he's demonstrating, telling everything about it. And I got a hold of him, and I said, you add a balun to that, and I'll bet you your front-to-back will be improved. He says, he looked at me, and said, who's this young so-and-so? And I said, I challenge you. I says, I'll challenge you, because I did it. And I said to him, why don't you do it and prove me wrong? In fact, I'll tell you what. I says, I'll tell you what. I says, I'll put, as they say, money on this. I says, you want to do it that way? I says, but I says, you've got to open your mind to this. And he says, no, I haven't got the time. And he fluffed me off, Dick. And I was so persistent, I fluffed me off. And later on, about within 6 months and all later, I got the thing to add on. You make a coil, a number of turns of coil. Used to be called the poor man's balun, and that's what sits up there at the TA-30. Mine's the TA-36, same driven element as the TA-33, and that's what sits up there, and that's what came through in the direct addendum from Mosley eventually, over.
I had basically the same exact experience with Carl.
Yeah, it sounds like he's a little bit of a hard hit. And it sounds like he had a belief that his antenna was perfectly balanced because his eye looking at the antenna convinced him it was, even though electronically it's not. And now your vertical piece of coax cable coming down the tower, radiating vertically polarized energy, and almost anything you hear on an HF frequency. You may be talking to a guy in London, and he swears on a pack of Bibles he's running horizontal polarization. You're running an antenna that's horizontally polarized, and you want to believe the signal is horizontally polarized. It's anything but. When that signal hits the ionosphere, which is a mixture of a plasma material and a Earth's magnetic field, it will experience Faraday rotation, a substantial amount of it. It's possible the signal twists a couple of times in polarization while going through the ionosphere, and when it arrives at your house, it may be slant 45-degree polarization with reference to the ground. You could say half the power is horizontal and half the power is vertical. And as such, if your coax cable is now radiating, and it's a vertical piece of cable coming down the tower and it's picking up that signal, you're going to be picking up a signal when your antenna is aimed away from London because you're picking it up with the coax. And you're going to say it's got poor front-to-back ratio. You'll blame it on the antenna, and it's really the way you're feeding the antenna. And so either doing this partially unbalancing technique on the driven element, or using a one-to-one balance, or using the poor man's balance, is a beautiful solution to that. That's a speculation on my part of what I think is going on. Howie, I know you wanted to add something to this. You got it, Howie, K2LIW.
Yes, Dick, if you use a balancer, can you...